Hello, and welcome to the Green Minds podcast.
Showcasing the science, stories, and solutions behind climate change with Phoebe Scott,
Alex Miller,
Lottie Flashkus,
and Guy Wilkinson.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Green Minds podcast. My name is Guy Wilkinson, and today I have the pleasure of introducing Andrew Mitchell.
Andrew has really had the most extraordinary career.
Starting off as the scientific coordinator for the Scientific Exploration Society, before joining BBC Science and the Natural History Unit. He was then co-founder of the Earthwatch Institute, founder and director of Global Canopy, and is now founder and CEO of Equilibrium Futures, which provides strategic advice on environmental risks and opportunities to the financial sector, specifically focusing on natural capital.
He has his own podcast called Don't Mess With Nature, which I would thoroughly recommend.
Andrew now lives on the island of Jersey, close to Durrell Zoo, which is where he discovered his passion for conservation. Andrew, thanks very much for coming on the show.
Well, hello, Guy. It's a pleasure to be here.
I think I could spend another half hour or maybe hour listing off your CV and your achievements, and I wouldn't even get halfway through. So why don't we start at the beginning? You graduated from Bristol University as a zoologist. What were you thinking at the time, and what did you want to go into, and why?
Well, I guess from an early age on a small island, growing up in a farm in a rather idyllic situation, spending a lot of time surfing on this small island, my window on the world outside was Durrell's Zoo. Gerald Durrell, a famous author who wrote My Family and Other Animals and many other good books, was one of the first people in the world, in fact, the first, to set up a zoo that was dedicated to endangered species. It's an extraordinary thing, but in those days, zoos were really places where people went to have fun and look at the animals. They weren't really a place that was linked to conservation. And Gerry Durrell said, well, why don't we just go for the species that are incredibly rare? We're the last chance saloon. And so he put them into this zoo. And it was there that I could see orangutans and chimpanzees. We saw cheetahs were declining very fast in Africa, and many other smaller animals. It was often the small ones that he went for. And this gave me a real interest in zoology, and of course his passion too through his books. I was able to, in those days, touch the fingers of the baby orangutans through the bath. And I thought, wouldn't it be fantastic to go and see them in the wild and see where they lived? And so I became a passionate supporter of conservation, zoology, and exploration. So having spent 3 years at Bristol University, I came out with a zoology degree and thought, what am I going to do then? What am I going to do now? And I met a wonderful guy called Colonel John Blashford Snell. And he was like somebody out of a Victorian adventure book. And he had a pencil thin moustache. He was quite tall and imposing and a big booming voice. And he said to me, what are you doing in Jersey? And I said, I'm not doing very much. I need a job. And he said, well, come over here to London because I've got an expeditionary office and I'll give you a job. And so that's what I did.
That's excellent and really interesting to hear. And actually, funnily enough, we're recording this the day after my birthday. And for my birthday, my girlfriend actually adopted me an orangutan from Durrell Zoo called Kia. So there's a bit of a funny coincidence there. And obviously you've been very lucky, traveled the world and to run these conservation projects. I think there's often a disconnect between the world of finance and business that we see in the West and the city and the impact that that has on the environment. So I was wondering if you could give us an idea of your most, perhaps your most vivid and memorable moment from your early career in the field. And then also the moment you realized how widespread humanity's destruction of the environment and biodiversity really is.
When I met Colonel Blashford Snell, he got me on organizing expeditions all over the world. As a young zoologist, aged 22 years old, with a beard and long black hair, I used to work 40 feet underground in the Ministry of Defense, old War Office building in Whitehall, and we planned expeditions all over the world. One of them was called Operation Drake, another was called Operation Rally. And by being part of these expeditions, I was able to go to unexplored areas of the world and experience the communities, then we used to call them tribal communities, that lived in the forests and very remote areas, and also encounter animals. And one of the most poignant moments for me was in the forests of Borneo with a Royal Geographical Society expedition there in 1978. Into the Mount Mulu range. Now, this area had barely been explored by Europeans. One or two people, Lord Shackleton, had climbed the big mountain there, 10,000 feet. But pretty much nothing was known about it. It was huge forests, giant trees that are as high as Nelson's Column. And it took us 3 days to get in there by canoe. I was there to study gibbons. These are apes that swing about in the treetops very high up. And we knew nothing about the primates in this area. And it became what is now today known as the Mulu National Park. If we hadn't created it, it wouldn't have survived. Great work with the Malaysian government. Well, during that expedition, I remember climbing to the summit of Mount Mulu. It took 3 days to get up there. And sitting on the summit in the early morning, looking out over these mountains, I saw an ocean of green as far as the eye could see. And I heard the wonderful sounds of the gibbons that were cavorting in the treetops below, calling to each other, different families across the valleys. And as I looked with my binoculars and tried to see them, and later walked down through the forests, I sat and waited. And a family of gibbons came down right beside me. Didn't know I was there. I was hiding under the bushes, so close I could almost touch them. They came down from their canopy world to meet my world on the ground. And it was then I got this idea of, why don't we go up in the canopy of the rainforest and explore that world, a totally unknown world inhabited by these primates. And so I took that idea back with me to London, to Colonel Blashford Snell, and said, why don't we build suspension bridges through the treetops? And no one had really done this very much. There was one built in Malaysia, but not around the world. And so he said, this is a brilliant idea. I'll get my engineers onto it immediately. So we got a whole lot of demolition ladders and so ropes and schemes. And years later in Panama, we built these between the treetops, and later in New Guinea and Indonesia and around the world. Well, aerial walkways are now used all over the world by tourism. But in those days, no one had really explored the forest canopy. And I was able to organize scientists to go up there and explore where life meets the atmosphere, climbing on climbing ropes, rope ladders, pushing out suspension bridges between the treetops so we could study where trees have their sex lives, right up in the treetops where all the flowers are, which you can't see from the ground. What I remember thinking back to Mount Mulu is, from that summit, remember I talked about the ocean of green. Well, today, it's all gone. It's no longer an ocean of green. It's an ocean of palm oil. So if you stood today on the summit of Mount Mulu, yes, it still looks a bit green, but almost all the forest around where all those gibbons that I did all my early research has all vanished, except for the island that we created, which is today the Mount Mulu Park. It's pretty big, 200 square miles. But this has happened all over the world. In my lifetime, Borneo has become a bomb site. It was covered in rich forest from end to end. Today, if you fly over it, it's all smashed to pieces. And I've seen this happen in my lifetime. And that, to me, is a terrible tragedy that I spent most of my life trying to put right and turn around.
Very interesting to hear. And I think this, sorry to bring it up, but the pandemic that we're currently in, I think has finally given everyone time to reflect on that and really think that this has happened in just one generation. And that if it's to happen again for the next generation, there really will be nothing left. So thank you for sharing that. Moving on now from your conservation career, you then went on to set up the Earthwatch Institute. So how did your early experience lead on to you setting that up? And perhaps you can also give us an idea of what the Earthwatch Institute does to this day.
On Operation Drake and Operation Rally, we took young people out on these expeditions almost for the first time. We took 400 of them on Operation Drake, and then 4,000 of them on Operation Rally. And people went out for 3-month phases. They were selected from all over the world. And Prince Charles was the patron of all of these things. And he had this concept of the challenges of war in peacetime, which sounds a little strange, but yeah, many young people want that kind of adventure in that period between leaving school and perhaps going to university or shortly after university. And that's what we provided, but doing some useful stuff along the way. And I thought when I finished up my work with them that it would be interesting to do the same thing, but for adults. And it turned out a friend of mine called Brian Rossborough had this program there called Earthwatch. And he said, why don't you help me get it going in England? I've been trying to get it going, but nothing's really happened. So I imported the idea of Earthwatch into the United Kingdom. And it was the first conservation volunteering organization for adults where you could go out and work with a scientist for 2 weeks and help save the earth. So if you wanted to be David Attenborough for 2 or 3 weeks, you could. And you went out and worked with scientists on dolphins, studying rainforests, doing archaeology, or anything with an ology on the end, we did it. And that's what we set up in Oxford with close links to the university as a new way of funding science with citizens. It was the beginning of citizen science.
That sounds really, really exciting. And you can still go on these expeditions now, is that right?
Yes, at its peak, I think Earthwatch was, I ended up in Boston managing the global program, and we were running 30 or 40 different expeditions in 30 countries around the world, sending out at least 5,000 people a year on them. I mean, this generated a huge amount of data, but also changed the lives of those thousands of people who went out and worked with scientists. They began to understand what science was all about.
Wow, sounds really amazing, and definitely something I think we should all look into before going into the world of work.
The thing is that when we did it, it was the only one. Now there's loads of conservation volunteering organizations, and I hundreds of them. And in fact, it's amazing that Operation Drake and Rally still go on today as Rally International. And I urge anyone who's thinking of an adventure like this to consider Rally International. All my children have been on it. It's two boys and a girl. And it changed their lives. 3 months in the field, working with people right at the cutting edge. It's got all the same values. Everyone, if they can, and remember, with Rally, you have to raise all your own money. You can't just get paid by your parents to go. So that's part of the scheme. It's a brilliant way to see the world.
So you set up Earthwatch Institute and ran the program in Boston, and then you went on to set up Global Canopy. So it'd be really great to hear everything that Global Canopy does and how you were involved in that.
This was a watershed moment for me, really, because I kind of took on Earthwatch because I needed a proper job. Before that, I'd been making films and working with the BBC, having a pretty dilettante life, a pretty good time. I got into writing books, and I just did a journey from Papua New Guinea to Easter Island, right across the South Pacific, because I was fascinated by that. And ended up in Easter Island, going around on horseback, wrote this book, which is called Nature and Man in the South Pacific. And I couldn't see myself necessarily making a living out of television or books. I thought I'd better get a prepper job because I was getting married. And I met my wife on Greystoke's The Legend of Tarzan, which was a movie, a huge Warner Brothers $60 million movie at the time. It was one of the big, it's a bit of a cult movie now, Greystoke, The Legend of Tarzan. She was organizing the movie and I was the rainforest advisor. She was going out with Tarzan at the time. So my chat up line was, what's the point of going out with a fake Tarzan when you can go out with a real one? It kind of worked because they're still married. And anyway, we were working in Boston, doing training in Boston. I came back. I was working for the UK office, and I was going backwards and forwards to Boston and working out of the UK. And I had had enough of Earthwatch. I wanted to do something else. And she said, my wife said, go out and get a proper job, earn some money. And this is the trouble with this environment stuff, is that it doesn't earn you a lot of money a lot of the time. It requires a huge amount of passion and dedication to get into it. And remember, when I started doing all this, the word environment had barely been invented. And when you said to people, you know, what the world needs to do is start saving rainforests and we shouldn't be spending all this money destroying the world, people used to move quietly to the other side of the room and say, you know, what sort of a nutter is he? And people used to accuse you of eating brown rice and having open-toed sandals, neither of which I had or did. It was not a mainstream occupation. And so I got to a point where I thought, I better go into making money. You know, what could I do? Maybe I should start a tourism company and earn lots of cash or go and do something different. But I couldn't, because I saw the rainforest that I loved burning everywhere, the groups that I'd worked with disappearing. And I just thought this whole forest canopy was going to come down around our ears. And I passionately felt I wanted to focus on saving rainforests. And so much against my wife's better judgment, I set up something. I got a bee in my bonnet about forest canopies, and I called it Global Canopy Program. And I set it up in Oxford in the plant sciences department in one room there, where a very kind man gave me a room and set me up. And I met a philanthropist who was a major supporter of conservation projects. And I said what I wanted to do was to generate a new program to explore forest canopies, teach people about rainforests, and in some way lead to something that could save them. And he said, well, I can if you can. And so he gave me a check for £25,000 and said, off you go. And he became one of our longest running donors throughout Global Canopy and setting it up. And I ran that for nearly 20 years. And we built it up in Oxford to be what is now today one of the best providers of intelligence on the destruction of rainforests and the role of companies' supply chains and the finance sector in it. That's what we ended up focusing on. But we spent many years in the beginning on climbing ropes and working with our French friends with hot air balloons and floating over the rainforest and understanding how could we sell rainforests differently. People used to think it was about trees and butterflies, but I realized the way to sell them is that they're like eco-utilities that are keeping our planet safe. We got into this whole business of the fact that rainforest burning were causing huge amounts of emissions, driving climate change. We got into the fact that they are the biggest sequestrators of carbon on the planet as a natural ecosystem along with oceans. And this changed the whole idea of what rainforests really were. And I got a huge amount of help with that from none other than Prince Charles. And he asked me to help him set up the Prince's Rainforest Project. And he said, what can I do? And I said, well, Your Royal Highness, what you can do is make a big noise. People will listen to you more than they'll listen to me. And so in 2009, we set up this the Prince's Rainforest Project. And it was an incredible experience. We were working in Kensington Palace. He'd moved some people out of one of the towers, and we ended up with a whole team of people working flat out to create a sense of emergency about rainforests. And he eventually published his plan, the emergency plan for rainforests. And this had a galvanizing effect with heads of state and governments around the world. We ended up raising about $4.5 billion for rainforests, which was the biggest amount of money to stop deforestation that had ever been raised. At the Copenhagen Climate Summit in 2009. So that was quite an achievement.
Amazing. I must admit, I hadn't heard about that side of things from your career. So that's really good to hear. And then, of course, Copenhagen, very unfortunately, ended up not perhaps being the success that everybody had dreamed of. Were you at all involved in that in any capacity?
Yes. Well, I spent almost 10 years of my life going to all these, the COPs, as they're called, the Convention of the Parties. The parties are the governments that signed up to the UN Convention on Climate Change. And this coming up next year is their 26th meeting. They've spent 26 years trying to figure out what to do about climate. And I got involved in these negotiations around about 2005-06, when nobody was talking about rainforests. They were only talking about energy and transport. And we said, look, you're not going to win the climate change battle unless you stop rainforest burning and look after natural landscapes as well. Well, all the people in the negotiations in those days, they didn't know anything about green stuff. They didn't even want it in the negotiations. They were all transport ministers and people who knew about oil and energy. So we had to have a huge effort with friends in the World Wildlife Fund and many others. And Global Canopy became a very forensic kind of organization, getting in there with extremely good information, gaining the trust of the negotiators and producing publications that they relied upon. And so by the time we got to 2009, whilst the climate in the energy side was doing badly, the climate as far as was doing well. And that's why we were able to get this incredible agreement to put in $4.5 billion to stopping rainforests burning. Sadly, it hasn't stopped rainforests burning because actually, put it this way, that's only equivalent to about $1 billion a year. It was about $1.2 billion a year we then started to look, what's the value of all the supply chains that are destroying forests? And it turned out it was 195 billion a year. How do you expect 1 billion a year to combat? Actually, it was about 150 to, and it depends how you calculate it, but you know, it was 100 times more, 150 times more money was being spent on destroying rainforests through the supply chains for food like palm oil, like timber, soy, cattle, beef, and so on, than was being put in to save them. So that gave me a clue. We have to change the movement of money or we're never going to battle.
It certainly gives you something to think about when you can't really compete with £4.5 billion against 150 times that. Moving on slightly, actually about an hour after we record this podcast, Global Canopy is launching a tool in partnership with a company called Trace, which is helping to track supply chains for big multinational companies and how they contribute to deforestation. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that project?
Yeah, well, throughout the early years of Global Canopy, I was trying to think, how can we take all this science data and use it to stop deforestation? And so we started to concentrate more and more on data. I enjoyed, you know, swinging on ropes through the trees and things and doing all that science. But in the end, that's not enough to save rainforests. So how do we deal with this big pile of money that's causing the destruction, which defeats conservation constantly? And so we started to focus on supply chains. And we thought, well, let's focus on soya, for instance. And we met up with some wonderful guys at the Stockholm Environment Institute, some other English guys, in fact, who are working up there. And we thought, how can we trace the movement of these commodities from where they're grown to where they're consumed? Nobody did that. Or they did. The big traders did it. The big companies did it. But they wouldn't tell you in a public forum where that stuff was grown and whether it was connected to deforestation. So you want to know when a shipload of soy is coming into The Hague in the Netherlands, how do you know whether that's been responsible for driving destruction of forests in the Amazon? No one could tell you that. So we hit on this idea of collecting VAT receipts. We collect hundreds of thousands of VAT receipts in Brazil. You can buy this data. And the VAT receipt gives you a date, a place, and an amount of money and the tonnage. So we could trace back to where these tons of soy were coming from very precisely. When you think Brazil is about the size of Western Europe, you know, if you knew it was coming from a small province in France, that was a very useful piece of data. Or it may be, and we could also then track it all the way from that little tiny province in the heart of the Amazon, all down the rivers or the roads to where it was shipped. We could get ports data on where that ship was going. We could track those ships by satellite. You could see they were going into Hong Kong. And then it gets more difficult. You could trace it all the way from the Amazon to Hong Kong, but not necessarily where it was going in China. We could get the data all the way into Europe, but not necessarily all the supermarkets it was being sent to or the farms. But this was a huge advance. So we developed this thing called Trace. And trace.earth, you could look it up. It's spelled with an S. So if you go to trace.earth, it shows in the spider diagrams where all this stuff is going all over the world. It was all due to me meeting a wonderful guy called Nicky Mardas, who is the guy who actually runs Global Canopy now. He was my deputy for years. He was much more into data than I was. And so he said, this is going to be all about big data and forests. So Global Canopy has turned itself from being a science, an exploratory organization and a political organization into one of the world's leading data providers on deforestation and supply chains.
Well, it's really, really interesting to hear. And I've checked out Trace myself, and it is a really cool tool. If any of our listeners do want to try and understand where a lot of their products that they buy every day in the supermarkets come from. Fantastic. So you've helped Global Canopy and then recently started a new company called Equilibrium Futures, which advises the financial sector on risk and also the opportunities that lie in natural capital. Would you mind taking us a little bit through that and what you've done with that project?
Yeah, well, it's sort of the idea came out when I thought, getting towards the end of my time with Global Canopy in Oxford, we with Trace, we started to want to think not only who was moving the actual commodities, you know, loads of soy or loads of palm oil, but who was financing it? Where was the money coming from? Because none of this can happen without money. So we started to look at who was financing these supply chains. And before that, I'd set up something called the Forest Footprint Disclosure Project, which was really asking companies to disclose the fact that they had a forest footprint. Most of them didn't even know what a forest footprint was. But if you're a paper company, where does your paper come from? If you're a clothing company, where does your clothing and all the raw materials for that come from? If you're making ice cream, how do you know the palm oil that's in the ice cream isn't causing deforestation in Southeast Asia? So they had to start disclosing it. Well, the people who asked them to disclose were the investors who owned those companies, the shareholders. And because otherwise they wouldn't listen to me running an NGO in Oxford, but they would listen to their shareholders, huge finance houses who had stakes in their company. And I don't mean the ones you eat. I mean a big ownership stake. So I got to learn about finance and pension funds, the giant pools of capital that are held by pension funds. That's your money and my money. It's the people's money. When you put your money in a bank, do you ever think what they're doing with your money? You just go to a hole in the wall and get some cash out to go and buy some beers that night. But what are they doing with all your money that's sitting in the bank? Well, of course, they're investing it. They're not always investing it in good things. And nobody knows whether it's good or bad. How do you assess what's good or bad or brown or green? This is a revolution that started probably a decade ago, but it's accelerated rapidly in the last 2 years. And it's called ESG. That means environment, social, and governance metrics. Are you well governed? Are you looking after your staff or your community or the people who work for you throughout your global supply chain? And what's your impact on the environment? Mostly they look at climate, but in the future, they're going to look at nature. So, and when beginning to understand that if you want to change the movement of money, you have to change the rules by which that money works. Today, if you're an investor, you can invest in a palm oil company in Asia. And you'll make a ton of money because that palm oil company that might be tearing down a rainforest to replace it with palm oil plantations, the cost of destroying the rainforest, all those species gone, the livelihoods that depended on it, do not appear in the share price of that company. They're called externalities, economic externalities. So you can make private profits with the palm oil company, but the costs are public costs that are visited on governments and the population for the loss of the rainforest. And that's the way business works today. So if you're looking inside a Bloomberg terminal, and if nobody knows what a Bloomberg terminal is, it's a piece of software that comes on a computer that's used for almost three quarters of the transactions of finance around the world. It's absolutely giant. Anybody who wants to know what's going on in the finance world uses Bloomberg terminals to figure it all out. They get full of data. And it's full of financial capital data. But until a few years ago, there was almost no data in Bloomberg terminals on natural capital data. And I know that because I put one of the first tools inside a Bloomberg terminal some years ago on water as an essential piece of natural capital. And Bloomberg had great foresight to do this. It was called the Water Risk and Valuation Tool. And it allowed people who wanted to invest in copper mining and gold companies to understand their water risk around the world, because mining uses a hell of a lot of water. And then how's water going to change with droughts and changing climate? You need to maybe map that out over 10, 20, 30 years. That's the kind of tool that they needed, and we helped design for them. So changing the movement of money means you've got to start working with the financial sector and these giant pools of capital. And I wanted to try and lighten their footprint on nature. And that's why I set up Equilibrium Futures as I slowly withdrew from Global Canopy. I'd still work very closely with Global Canopy. And I wanted to focus on how do we get the financial sector to understand nature-related risk. And I got some help. And it came this year. And it's called COVID-19.
I was about to say that, yeah. It has, in some ways, I suppose, been a blessing in disguise in terms of realization of the trouble we're in. And if we can't change our ways. Tell us a little bit about Equilibrium Futures, and you talk about how you've advised the use of green bonds and how that they can be used to protect the rainforest in Indonesia, for example, I think is what you talk about. Would you mind telling us a little bit about the mechanisms of that?
Yes. The ultimate thing you need to do is to try to change money from being largely nature negative, which a lot of it is, into being nature positive. And you probably hear quite a lot about ethical finance and things like that. And some people who might want, you know, young people who are looking to create a pension fund in the future, you might want to have an ethical fund. Ethical funds tend to be about excluding things. It might be weapons or tobacco or drugs. You might want to exclude that from your portfolio. But impact investing is more about what you include in the portfolio. In other words, investing in renewable energy rather than fossil fuels, or electric cars rather than petrol cars. It's a positive thing. And ultimate impact investing is when you're investing to try and help, say, protect a rainforest or produce sustainable commodities. There are very, very few of those, but one of them is called Mirova Natural Capital. And I'm an advisor to Mirova through Equilibrium Futures. And what we do at Mirova is we raise funds at the scale of about 100 million to 150 million. You often need help from governments to do this because we're investing right at the cutting edge of conservation. So, for example, one of our investments, one of our funds is deployed into Latin America and in Peru, and there's a Cordillera Azul National Park. You've got a whole lot of local people living around the park. In the old days, they were all growing cocaine. You need to get them off cocaine and into cocoa and to have a better, more sustainable and legal life. And with the cocaine plantations, they were eating into the rainforest because it's very high value and causing the destruction of forests. That requires a huge amount of investment, gaining their confidence, and that they can make more money out of cocoa over the long term than they would out of cocaine. So with the work with local NGOs and people who know it on the ground, we work with those farmers, we educate them, change them, and provide the money they need to buy new equipment, to put in processing plants, and to stabilize that forest frontier using funds. It's risky stuff. So governments have to come into the fund and they provide some of the high risk money. Then above that, you get development agencies coming in and putting in a bit more money. And then you get retail agencies, maybe a major bank or something like that, will put in some of their money as well. And you end up with this fund and we deploy capital that way. And this was really new for, you know, 10 or 11 years ago, almost no one was doing this. Now it's becoming much more acceptable as people look for impact investing, and where Mirova is growing to almost up to $1 billion in funds. And we're getting more and more money in to try and do this. We've got the first sustainable ocean fund as well, looking at stabilizing, for instance, mangroves to stop tsunamis, at the same time growing sustainable shrimp farms with not just one species of shrimp, but lots of animals that are good for the coast rather than bad for the coastline. Don't destroy mangroves. All of that kind of thing is growing as the world of impact investing. And that's one of the things I advise on.
That's really exciting. And it's something that I increasingly see all over my social media and the news today is the release of these new exciting funds and new ways of investing your money. So you might have heard of Make My Money Matter by Richard Curtis, who's the director of and writer of Love Actually in Notting Hill. But he now has another worthy cause, and then the Share Action as well, who look to hold companies to account with what they're doing with the environment. So that's really cool to hear. We've had a few conversations and we sort of alluded to it on this podcast where it all just does come down to money somewhat. And a lot of the investments that I think you mentioned with Mirova Capital, for example, are all around natural capital. So can you perhaps give a viewpoint on the opportunity for financial institutions on natural capital?
Well, I think it's going to be as big as the change that's happened in renewable energy, in that we're going to need something very, very new in the future. And I call it renewable food. What's happened in the past is we had all this fossil fuel and coal business that was providing cheap energy for decades, but unfortunately it had a lot of collateral damage and it's destroyed, is destroying our atmosphere and changing the climate. And it's nature that actually kept things in balance, because many years ago, the atmosphere is about 95% CO2, but today is 0.004%. And the way all that CO2 was taken out of the atmosphere was down to two things, trees and plankton. They absorbed this carbon dioxide and stored it under the ground in chalk and limestone in the sea, and obviously in peat and coal in the form of trees. Nature is the best way of keeping our Earth safe, and we're destroying it. So we can't go on like that. Well, we've got the message on climate and oil, that part. The next thing we've got to get the message on is about the nature part, the rest of it. And the biggest problem we have there is the global food system, which is the biggest destroyer of nature on the planet. Our diets are causing a major problem. We eat so much beef that it's rolled back rainforests, so much palm oil that's rolled back rainforests. And so many other things that we do in agriculture are destroying the soil. Intensive agriculture is on a dead end with bigger and bigger machines, smaller and smaller numbers of people, increasingly creating a cloud of chemistry that's killing soil. That's got to stop. And so we're going to see renewable food emerge in the future. We're seeing changing diets towards veganism and vegetarianism. That's all good stuff. We need to rely far less on meat. I'm not a vegetarian, but I do eat less and less meat and keep it down as small as you can. And I eat a fraction of the meat that I used to eat. It's crazy when you go to a New York restaurant, because if you go to Indonesia and you have a meal with meat, it's a pile of vegetables with a few little tiny bits of meat on top and some nice sauce. You go to an American restaurant, you can't even see the vegetables anymore. They're underneath a giant steak, and it's all got topsy-turvy. So veganism is going to change food. New kinds of foods, systems like vertical farming are going to change food. And then we're seeing totally novel foods like Beyond Meats and Impossible Meats, which are totally changing the food system. Though you've got to watch out for those, because, of course, what do they use as their feedstock? It's back to that old soya again. And if they really scale up, where are they going to get their soy sustainably? Hopefully not from the Amazon. So I think we're going to see natural all that means that just in the same way in renewable energy, there are fantastic business opportunities that have risen over the last few decades, and electric cars being the big boom thing. Now, we're going to see the same thing happen with sustainable fashion, sustainable food, and all of those areas which are linked to natural capital, sustainable infrastructure, buildings being made out of wood rather than concrete, getting away from plastics, going back to natural. Do you know what nature's invention of plastic is? You only have to look at nature for a lot of these things. It's called chitin. It's what insect bodies are made of. That's nature's version of plastic. Think about it. A beetle's carapace is really hard and black, but yet a dragonfly's wing is see-through and entirely flexible. And the shells of shrimps, these are all nature's inventions of plastic. And unlike a plastic bag, if you toss it in the sea, it dissolves in the soil. It becomes a fertilizer. So nature's figured a lot of these things out. So we need to move to a circular economy where nothing is wasted. A rainforest is the best example of a circular economy on the planet. It sips energy from the sun, produces a tiny amount of waste, yet it gives life to the biggest things on the planet, giant trees, and some of the tiniest ones as well, all living in a state of dynamic equilibrium, changing fast. There are winners and losers, but the whole system is in a balance with nature. It sips its energy, leaves are like solar panels, and it doesn't waste anything. And that's the kind of model we've got to move towards. But to do that, we have to wake up the money, which is the fuel in our system. That's we're all drowning in money, doing the wrong thing. And so I've got one last tale to tell you on that, really, I think, which was how I was able to catalyze the task force on nature-related financial disclosure.
Please go ahead.
Well, this was 2 years ago at the Davos Economic World Forum. And this is when, you know, I sometimes call it the biggest corporate bottom-sniffing contest on the planet. All the big dogs of the world come in to Davos and think about how they're going to manage their businesses better. And up till now, it's mostly been, how do I continue to make profits? But What has come into the conversation in recent years, and is quite remarkable, is nature. And the realization that just infinite profit-making without looking after natural capital, human capital, and social capital at the same time as financial capital is not a recipe for a healthy business. And that we're coming up against the buffers on some of these limitations. And so new ideas are coming. And one of the ideas I had was that there'd been a thing called the Task Force on Climate Change, the TCFD, the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosure, that Mark Carney and Michael Bloomberg had set up. He's the man who invented those Bloomberg terminals I talked about. And Mark Carney used to run, was governor of the Bank of England. And they set about creating this task force. And it's amazing to see how they created a reporting framework on climate. What that means is that if you're running a pension fund and you're investing in fossil fuels or coal, you can continue to do that. But you've got to tell people you're doing it. You've got to report on it because you're stoking climate change. And everyone should know that. And then other people can make a choice whether they want to put their money in that pension fund or move it somewhere else. And of course, people don't want to do that. They're making loads of money out of oil companies and coal companies. But those sorts of businesses are going to lose money in the future. And so it's sensible for them to start shifting their money elsewhere. I thought, why can't we do the same thing for nature? And I was sitting at a dinner, and by chance, I rolled back. I was on the wrong side of the mountain. I don't know if anybody's ever been to Davos, but it's a it's a big town. It's nestled in the Swiss mountains. It's covered in snow. There's big mountains all around. You can't stay in Davos when the forum is on because it's incredibly expensive. So I was staying on the other side of the mountain, and I had to get across the mountain really fast. I'd been held up. I was staying with some friends for free, and I had to get across the mountain. So I knew I wasn't going to be, I wanted to do a bit of skiing and decided to put my suit on and then put my very old onesie over the whole top, zipped it up, put on my skis, took the cable car to the top of the mountain and sped like James Bond down the side of the mountain as fast as I could go to get to a crucial meeting on climate and finance. And so when I got there, I was able to unzip my onesie, and rather to the surprise of everybody, stepped out in my suit and tie. There was a dinner that night, and by chance, I found myself sitting next door to the advisor, to Mark Carney, the governor of the Bank of England. And I said to him, what about this idea of setting up a task force on nature-related financial disclosure, which would be a twin for climate? And he said, oh, do you know, I think that'd be a really good thing. And we ended up having quite a conversation about it at the dinner table. That's how these things start. And so I got confidence that perhaps within the financial sector, and crucially within the bank regulators, because they are the high priests of the finance system, they set the rules for the movement of money right across the world. So I thought, I can get in with those high priests of the financial system and talk to them about nature. Well, in April that year, I was invited to something called the NGFS, which is the Network for Greening the Financial System. And it's not a network of you and I or university students. It's a network of bank supervisors, meaning the regulators, the high priests again. This is the network, and they've actually got greening in their minds. They're thinking about, how do we green the financial system? But they're thinking about climate. I wanted them to think about nature. So I was invited to that, and I was luckily able to speak and talk to them about, you know, greening. You've got to go beyond carbon. You've got to think of nature. That's the next big thing. It's not just about climate. You've got to do nature as well. And all of this has started a chain reaction, if you like. And I've talked about some of these things in my podcast. I ended up being able to chat to the governor of the Banque de France and various others, teamed up with the World Wildlife Fund, who are really activating in Paris on this, with the United Nations Development Programme. And you start pulling all these threads together. And 2 years later, we have a task force on nature-related financial disclosure now being designed by 63 financial institutions, bank regulators, and governments. And we launched it in September this year. And I said a moment ago that COVID-19 was the catalyst. It was not so much the catalyst as the accelerator, because I was able to explain to pension funds and banks that COVID-19 is a perfect example of unrecognized nature-related financial risk. It's a tiny speck of life that's turned everything upside down. It's completely changed our economies. It's completely changed our way of life. And why did it happen? It happened because of the destruction of nature, because the landscapes in Africa and Asia, where illegal wildlife trade is being spawned by poor people who are moving into the rainforest, having their landscapes destroyed around them, and are shipping 100,000 pangolins a year into southern Vietnam and China. And these species are coming in from all over the world, being mixed up in markets like the Wuhan market. Bats, pangolins, koala bears, dogs, cats, snakes, you name it. And this creates a high-pressure breeding ground, an experimental ground for viruses. And coronaviruses are living in wildlife, but through what's called zoonotic transfer, get transferred to humans. And what seems to have happened is it came from a bat, went through pangolins, and then into humans in Wuhan, and got turbocharged there, and then escaped and got out around the world. And it's turned everything upside down. It's so far cost governments $12.5 trillion in funds trying to prop up economies around the world. And I wrote an article for the World Economic Forum in January this year, and I called it COVID-19, the $10 trillion wake-up call to finance from nature. And they said, oh, $10 trillion, that's way too big. I don't think we better call it that. Do you know what? We've already surpassed it. So we have to understand nature-related risk, and finance gets it now. Governments get it now. The public get it now. And that's why we all need to be thinking about making our money matter. When you put your money in a bank, put your money in a pension fund, we need to be asking questions about what it's funding. And that's going to be very transformative for the movement of money in the future. So by creating this task force, we're going to be able to create a new framework, a new methodology. We're going to be able to influence the rules for the movement of money. And in time, we'll be able to know whether your portfolio is nature positive or nature negative. Just as today, we're going to know whether your portfolio is pro-climate or against climate. This is going to do more to change the movement of money around the world than anything else I can think of.
Well, that's a really powerful message to hear. And I think that $12 trillion figure that it's cost the world, it really is probably the best place to end this podcast and also take away from this podcast in terms of going into the future and really making an effort to change things. So we do have just two final questions to sum up for you, Andrew. What advice would you give to young people today?
Never give up. Never give up if there's something you really want to do, because to get where you want to go is not an easy thing to do. And it certainly wasn't easy to do in the world of environment, which nobody cared about or even knew existed when I was 22 years old. You need to get your foot in the door and keep talking until somebody opens it. So it does require determination. The second thing is you need to get relevant experience. You know, it's really hard to get into any sector if you've got nothing, no real experience. Just getting a good degree in anthropology and archaeology isn't necessarily going to guarantee you a pathway into a good job. So you've got to get some experience as well, which is why I was so lucky to go off around the world and get that experience. I knew what life was like at the front line of the subject I was interested in my case, environment and saving nature. Not everybody wants to do that. But so I think those two things is determination, get a good training for your mind, that's a degree, and then get some relevant experience, and then never give up.
That's a really good piece of advice, I think, for some of our listeners. And lastly, the final question from today, if listeners were to take away one thing from this episode of the IB Green Minds podcast, what would you want it to be?
It would be to think differently about money. In the future, money isn't just there to buy pints and good evenings in the pub, because we all need to save money in order to do that. We all need to earn money in order to do that. And the way it's worked up to now is that we put our money in things over the long term. Most people listening probably won't have a pension fund. You do need to think about that at some point in your life, because you do need your old age to be have something there for you. Have a think about what are good banks or good pension funds. Think about making your money matter in life. And I think over the next generation, this is going to have a big effect on what businesses get financed and what new products are created. We need to bring the costs of nature, the externalities, which are not included in the price of things, into the frame, because it will change the way we move money. You know, if the true cost of petrol was paid at the pump, it would probably be £15 a litre or more. It's because the damage to our atmosphere is not included in the petrol you might put in your car that we get this entirely false price signal. It's worse than that. It's subsidized to destroy our atmosphere to the tune of about $550 billion a year. And we subsidize food that's destroying nature to the tune of $750 billion a year. And it gives us an impression that food we buy in the supermarket is cheap. It's not cheap. Unsustainable food is very, very expensive. Sustainable food is the cheap food. But we need to change the rules of money to make it look that way, because it's pointless that the sustainable option in life should be the expensive option. That should be the cheap option. The unsustainable options should be the ones that are priced out of business. And I think in your lifetime, that's what's going to happen.
Well, I certainly hope so.
Andrew, we've covered a number of points from this episode today, from thinking about how finance and nature can work together
to opportunities in chitin as opposed to plastic and all sorts of other gems. So I hope our listeners have learned a lot from this episode. Andrew, thanks very much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. I think we could probably talk for hours more. I certainly would love to at some point. If you'd like to check out his podcast, it's called Don't Mess With Nature. I'd highly recommend it. Andrew, thanks once again.
Thank you, guys. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.